It's a great pleasure. It's a great year to tell us about physics, math, and machine learning.
Well, thank you, David. Thank you, Sabrina. We had a great chat earlier this morning, and I look forward to continuing it. So if there are questions after the talk, during the talk, feel free to ask. Since it's still morning and I don't know many of you, let me try to wake you up a little bit and ask a poll question. How many of you like physics? Okay, you're actually quite awake. How many of you like math? Okay. How many of you had to analyze data at some point? Okay, very good. I'm in the right place. So I apologize for cycling through these three subjects. Hopefully, it will be not much of a fire hose kind of presentation. There will be obviously some structure to it, but there will be three different topics completely mixed in, so I hope it's not going to be all about nothing. And the problem I'll try to solve is going to be very concrete. So throughout the talk, I'll focus mostly on this question, which is known as the interesting Poincaré conjecture. The original one in three dimensions was solved 20 years ago by Perelman, so that's cool. But even before it was solved, everybody was actually more interested in smooth Poincaré conjecture in dimension 4. So the question is, if what looks like a sphere is actually a sphere. We know the answer to this question in all dimensions other than 4. So we know that exotic things can happen in dimensions above 4. Below 4, things are easy enough. So thanks to Perelman for proving what everybody expected. What's cool about this conjecture in dimension 4 is that we actually have no clue. If you poll topologists, half of them will tell you that we expect the conjecture to be true. Half of them will say that we expect the conjecture to be false. I find this super exciting, because if you don't know now, the answer either way will be super interesting. It's not like in dimension 3 where we expected what should happen. So here is the strategy, or I mean, there are many ways to approach it, but here is one possibility. So if you find a pair of knots in three dimensions which have these three properties, then you become famous because you disprove Poincaré conjecture. You rule it out, it's false. And, yeah?
About 4, it is not correct, this conjecture, about 4, dimension 4.
About dimension 4, that's not correct, why?
This is what you mean, or I misunderstood.
No, what I mean is that if you prove, so you're asking about theorem or conjecture. Conjecture is open, we don't know if it's true or false.
For dimension larger than 4, it is not correct.
Oh, in dimension other than 4, we know, so the graph is roughly like this. So what I mean is that dimension 4 is very special. So if this is dimension, so this is D for d-dimensional spheres, we know more or quite a bit about whether exotic things can exist above dimension 4. For example, famous one is D equals 7, or Milner had famously 28 exotic spheres, and so on. So complexity in some sense goes down that way. It also goes down this way, because in dimensions 1 and 2, manifolds are very simple, so many structures align. Topological smooth categories have become the same, basically. But dimension 4 is like, I don't know if it's a good analogy, you can think about this as a pole in this graph of complexity function. So this is complexity versus dimension 4 for the spheres.
Okay.
So that's what I mean. That it picks up here. It becomes very special, very, very hard. So that's where we ask the question, is there exotic four sphere? Yeah, that's what the question is asking. And what theorem says is that, yes, there is, if, and then there are three conditions. So if you find pair of knots, K and K prime, which have these three properties. So I'll tell you in a second what slice means, but there are zillions of knots in topology, and each one is either slice or not slice. It's a binary yes or no decision question. So therefore, if there are zillions of knots, there are zillions of slice, there are zillions of not slice. So this is easy to satisfy, the last two. So if they share something in common called zero surgery, I'll explain in a second what that means, then that's it. We succeeded. So all we have to do is to find this pair which share these properties. And I want to emphasize that every two properties out of three are extremely easy to meet. For example, there are also zillions of knots or pairs of knots which share the same zero surgery. So every two conditions are easy to satisfy. The only question, can we satisfy all three at once? If we find such a pair by exhaustive search, some other way, that's it. We go home, Poincaré conjecture in four dimensions is solved. So that's the problem I want to solve. So the rest of the talk is about how or why. And before I do that, I have to explain some of the terms that appeared on the previous slide. For example, what sliceness means and what is the zero surgery. If there are questions at any point, feel free to ask. So this first part is about math, and the problem is math, and that's actually what I care about most these days. So what is surgery? So every three manifold, so here we go to three manifolds, not four manifolds, can be constructed out of knots and links by removing knots and links and gluing them back with various twists. So this is called surgery operation, and this famous theorem from topology says that every three manifold on Earth can be built in this fashion, using this method. So surgeries are labeled by rational numbers, here denoted P over R. And these numbers basically tell us how exactly we glue back the neighborhood of a knot once we excavate it. So among these rational numbers, which parameterize different ways of filling back the hole, a couple of them are very special, so illustrated here in this diagram. Infinity surgery, with this surgery coefficient being infinity, it basically glues back the solid torus, the neighborhood of a knot, in exactly the same way we had it before, so we get back the three spheres. So nothing happened. It's infinity surgery on any knot or link returns back the same manifold, so that's not interesting. Zero surgery, on the other hand, is complete opposite. In some sense, it produces a three manifold out of a knot or link, which maximally remembers information about the knot or link. And there are lots of interesting questions in low-dimensional topology which focus specifically on the zero surgery. So the zero surgery not only appears in potential counterexamples to Poincaré conjecture, but it also was the subject of so-called property R, which was famously proved by Gabay in the 80s, and many, many other instances in low-dimensional topology. So this is very kind of special for a number of reasons. And that's the one we're going to need. So sliceness, so this is also about knots and low-dimensional topology, is a property of knots. As I mentioned, it's a binary thing. So every knot is called, a knot is called slice if it bounds a disk in four-dimensional ball. So here is an illustration. You can think about knot as, I'll use the PI-style pointer here. So if this is a knot, and this is kind of the four-dimensional, or of course we cannot draw a four-dimensional ball, but you can imagine that this is fourth dimension, and in this fourth dimension extends topologically a disk which is bounded by the knot. So if this property exists, or for a given knot, or if this disk is found, we declare that it's slice. If not, then it's not slice. So not surprisingly, the sliceness uses fourth dimension. So it's a property about four-dimensional balls. So that's why potential connections to four manifolds upon correct conjecture in dimension four arise, because yes, even the property itself refers to four manifolds, but in a very basic way. It's a property of knots. Now, here there is another term on this slide. There is another binary property of knots called ribbon. So ribbon is basically the same as slice if this disk, which is illustrated here, has only minima but no maxima. So in other words, if you choose a Morse function to be the radial function on the four-dimensional ball in which this surface sits, and you can find such a disk without maxima, then this is a stronger property. Then you say that your knot is ribbon. And famous conjecture by Ralph Fox, going back to 60s, I think it's 1962, says that he expects, and many of us actually expect, that slice is the same as ribbon. In other words, the stronger version is the same as the weaker version. But this is open conjecture. This is actually another 60-year-old conjecture in topology that hasn't been proved for all these years, and it would be good to understand. There are various potential counterexamples to smooth punk rack conjecture I mentioned before, and this slice ribbon conjecture. So these are probably two coolest questions in low dimensional topology. So these are kind of questions I want to focus on. And again, they hinge on these properties of sliceness and ribbonness. And counterexamples, such as the one coming from this paper is about 10 years ago. It mentions, for example, this property 2R, which is advancement on property R that I mentioned before, discusses the slice-ribbon conjecture and many other good things. And here, it offers infinite a family of potential counterexamples such that the smallest member of the family is this knot, and it has 48 crossings in the minimal diagram presentation. Okay? So therefore, what we need to know, again, to summarize the previous couple of slides, we need to know some yes or no properties of knots which have 48 crossings and going up in complexity. So 100 crossings, 200 crossings, and so on. For questions which are really meaningful to topology, that's what we need. Any questions so far? Okay, so this is what we have. In my past life, I worked on quantum topology a lot, and I didn't ask myself, can I actually compute something at this number of crossings? And the answer is pretty much no. Because first of all, complexity of knots, if we classify them by crossings, for example, the way we do it here, grows factorially, exponentially. It grows very, very fast. Secondly, any practical computation of quantum invariance, which uses either Skine relations, R matrices, anything, is going to be exponential in number of crossings because we have to sum over some channels in this crossing diagrams when we glue things. And it's an exponential computation. So in practice, what happens in quantum topology, we can handle 10 crossings. Usually, that's where people stop. Powerful computers in modern age can handle maybe, I don't know, 14, 16 crossings. For example, Lisa Piccirillo answered the question about sliceness, exactly the kind of question that we need to know, for 11 crossing knot called Conway knot a couple of years ago. And this is where technology is, with either paper and pencil or modern usual computer calculations. So we are stuck here in this range of, I don't know, 10 plus crossings, 16 crossings. Whereas what we need is either this example that I showed before or potential counterexamples to smooth punk rack conjecture where we need this sliceness properties all start hanging near 70 crossings, 100 crossings, and again, this come in infinite families, so they go further, so there are lots of them, but they're much, much more complicated. So there is a huge gap between what we can do, or I could do at least in past life, and what we actually need in low dimensional topology. This is a little bit of an issue because even if I assume Moore's law, that technology improves also exponentially, that computational power doubles, for example, every year or two, then what it means is that if this year we can do 16, next year we can do 17 crossings and so on. You're basically plotting one exponential against the other, or on a log scale, it's going to be linear progression. What this means is that if next year we can do 17 crossings, by the time we're going to reach this range, I'm probably going to be gone, and I want to see the solution to the problem. So, therefore, we need something faster, something better, something that at least I can hope to see in my lifetime. So, therefore, in the past years, we tried to, or at least I with various colleagues, tried to approach this problem in many different ways, including math, physics, and machine learning, and that's what I'm going to tell you about. The questions in low-dimensional topology, again, are very concrete. It's basically yes or no questions. So there is absolute truth out there, and the question is, can we get to it? So for every knot, with either 50 or 100 or 10 crossings, there is an answer. It's, for example, slice or not slice. It's very concrete, and again, answer is out there. Question, can we extract it? So using physics, one can try, and this has been, to some extent, done. For instance, when we talk about knots, what's interesting is that very few knot invariants can detect this property, the sliceness or ribbonness that I mentioned. It's kind of surprising because We have, for example, from physics point of view, Trans-Siemens theory, and you can try evaluating Wilson loop expectation values for many, many different groups and for many, many different representations. There are infinitely many choices, but none of those usually detect this delicate property. So what does is something homological where you compute vector space valued invariants of knots, and that's also not enough. So you basically need to categorify quantum group invariants first, and then you have to look at spectral sequences. And it turns out that somewhere deep down in those spectral sequences, the information about sliceness may be present. I say may because chances are slim, and so far, basically, it's being only 1%, a small fraction of those homological invariants in spectral sequences, which reveal something that's interesting about this property. So it's kind of peculiar. But anyway, we can try to continue on this path. So what this diagram illustrates is spectral sequences in BPS spectra. And in past 20 years, this has worked reasonably well for knots, where you can construct spectral sequences for knot homologies. For three-manifold homologies, this is work in progress, and this is actually something that I hope to report maybe on my next visit to Perimeter Institute. And by trying to study BPS spectra of three-manifolds, you can actually get a little bit closer to what you need. So maybe you can, in some sense, expedite the process of accessing interesting questions about four-manifolds. But you still have to deal with vector space valued invariants. And another option is you can go directly to four-manifold invariants and study, for example, invariants for four-manifolds or surfaces in four-manifolds. Then you're basically directly accessing questions about sliceness or exotic metrics on four-manifolds. And here you don't need complicated invariants. You don't need spectral sequences, but there is a trade-off that you need to work directly with four-manifolds. So it's kind of a balance. In this lower row, you have to study more advanced invariants, but in simpler setting. In the top row, you have to study simpler invariants in more advanced setting. And again, there has been work in many of these directions, but with limited success. So I'll try to say a few words about it and explain why limited success. One way in which the study can go is the following. You can take everybody's beloved, at least in physics and string theory, six-dimensional zero-two theory and put it on either three-manifold and four-manifold. As a result, you get something out of it. Either simple dimension count tells you that you get either two-dimensional theory or three-dimensional theory. And you can ask about BPS spectra in those theories and in particular spectral sequences and so on. So this is good strategy. And again, for knots, it has worked. But with knots, we have their own problem because they're kind of as far from four manifolds as possible. With three manifolds, we can get a little bit closer. In particular, we can try to study those zero surgeries more directly as three manifolds. But here, what we can do, we can, at present, compute only graded character of this BPS spectra. We cannot really compute vector space valued invariants. And the problem is that there are various mathematical tools which have been developed recently based on quantum groups at generic Q that allow us to compute this at the level of numbers. But we don't actually have direct access to this theory T of M3 that appears in the 3D-3D correspondence, or we don't have direct access to its BPS spectra. So that's the issue. And as I mentioned before, if we remain at the level of knots and three manifolds, we need spectral sequences. So that's something you cannot do just with numbers. You need actually vector spaces to access that. So what's the challenge with this theory T of M3 or 3D-3D correspondence? So let me try to illustrate this with a simple, another poll question. So question here in physics is, if I take this 6D theory and using the same definition I showed on a previous slide, compactify it on a two torus, do I get 4D n equals 4 maximally supersymmetric Young-Mills theory? So 6D02 theory is maximally supersymmetric CFT in six dimensions. Its compactification on two torus does not break any supersymmetry. And there is only one 4D super maximally supersymmetric Young-Mills theory with that much supersymmetry that we know and love. So natural expectation that they should be yes, that they are the same. One is maximally supersymmetric, the other is maximally supersymmetric. So how many of you think that I'm on the right track, that the answer is yes? Okay, I see some hesitance. How many of you think that the answer is no, that I'm on the wrong track? Well, I also see some hesitance. You know the answer, so that's not. Well, the answer is no. But funny thing is, 10 years ago, many people would probably have said yes, including myself. So the expectation was exactly, yeah, they're maximally supersymmetric. You compactify 1 on T2, you get n equals 4 super Young-Mills. In fact, the cell-to-z symmetry of T2 would be used to advocate for electric-magnetic duality of super Young-Mills. These days, there are many ways to explain that the answer is no. In fact, slickest probably comes from Davide and friends, which says, let's look at other symmetries, not just supersymmetry. For instance, and we can actually see the answer even if algebra group in 6 dimensions is something like U1, that would be free tensor multiplet theory, or SU2. In either case, you have center symmetry, two-form symmetry in 6 dimensions. So if you compactify your 6-dimensional theory on T2, what you get is a theory which has these symmetries. It has two-form symmetry, zero-form symmetry, and 2 1-form symmetries. If you're worried about polarization, you would have to choose half of those. That's not even going to be needed for what I'm going to say next. This structure you can easily read off from the Hodge diamond, the Betti numbers of a 2 torus, which has exactly the same disposition and the degrees such that degrees of these different symmetries shift a little bit. Either way, maximally supersymmetric Young-Mills in 4 dimensions has 1-form symmetries, and people have studied them at length, but no one has ever saw either 0-form or 2-form symmetry in 4D n equals 4 super Young-Mills. So that's it. Very quick, easy argument to say that they're not the same, they have nothing to do with each other. And then if you look more closely, you can notice that anomalies are different. I mean, they do have something to do with each other. Of course, they're related, and I'll try to show it on the next slide. But it's a different theory. So, and this is the issue with T of M3, T of M4, that you can construct approximations to these theories, which are pretty good, Lagrangian sometimes. In fact, David and I also did this when we were much younger. But these are still approximations where they describe part of the story, not the full story. So that's the difficulty. So I'll spend one more minute on this physics approach, and since it's not going to work anyway, I'll abandon it and I'll switch gears. So to amuse you a little bit more with this example, you can see this actually zero-form or two-form symmetries that they're needed in several different ways. At the level of Coulomb branches, for instance, Coulomb branch of, again, let's just take group SU2, simplest possible. Coulomb branch of maximally supersymmetric Young-Mills with simplest non-abelian group is going to be like this. It's a single plane. It's a U-plane with one special point in the origin where, if you look carefully, monodromy is -1, and then this is the type of singularity. So if you look at 6D theory compactified on a 2-torus, what you find is something quite a bit different, and this is crucial. So first of all, you find cylindrical moduli space. Instead of a plane, U-plane, you find a C-star-valued U-plane. So that's already quite a bit different. And you can start again with a single tensor multiplet, just abelian 6-dimensional theory. So then the answer is going to be like this. If you consider SU2, which is also rank 1, you'll find C star mod Z2, which has 2 fixed points. So it's asymptotically cylindrical. It's not even like a plane. So you can see the difference if you go far out on the Coulomb branch. And it has 2 fixed points, which are exactly of this type. And monodromy at each one is -1. So in total, you get monodromy over here +1, which is what you would expect from 6 dimensions more directly. So the point is that they're quite a bit different, and in fact, it is this symmetry, circular symmetry of the asymptotics of the Coulomb branch in this T of T2 theory, which is responsible for the zero-form, two-form symmetries that we're discussing. If you go further down, things just get worse. If you either increase the rank or dimension of the manifold on which you're compactifying, you'll find more and more discrepancies between something naive like this maximally supersymmetric theory with Lagrangian description and what T of M should or wants to be. For instance, in the case of a three torus, you would find that you have not just one, but three periodic directions, even for the gauge group SU2. And therefore, your theory would look like something of this sort. You would have, say, C star cross C star cross C star cross C divided by Z2 with eight now, instead of two, 8 points. Each one looks like ABGM, but they're all glued together in the same moduli space. And we don't have very good descriptions of these theories. So with my colleagues, we proposed various Kermion-type theories with group-valued fields to deal with this problem. But again, techniques. So what we need is not only good description of these theories, but techniques to compute their BPS spectra and spectral sequences. And again, this is something that probably can be done. And again, I hope that later on I'll come and report on this work. But it hasn't been done yet. So there is a big gap because we need, on the one hand, to do it for pretty much general three manifolds, not just one by one. Here I show just one example, which was painful. But we need to do it for millions of manifolds to answer interesting questions in topology. And again, we're very far from that at this point. OK, any questions so far? So 5 years ago, I was very frustrated with the state of affairs, which didn't change much in the past year. So I tried to look somewhere else. And lots of things were happening. So in particular, there was this hype about AI and so on. And I actually tried to learn about it to mostly convince myself that this is not something I need to invest my time in seriously. What happened is complete opposite. I actually convinced myself that this is something I should really pay attention to. So I'll just tell you the story why. And part of the story will be also somewhat historical in a sense. If you pay attention to the dates, you'll see quite clearly some things that happened around 2015, which was more or less this transition point and big revolution in AI. Also, another remark is that until very recently, I had to apologize because proceeding with what I'm going to tell you next, I would be only focusing on very small subset of what machine learning community does. It's related to natural language processing, natural language understanding, which is small part. But luckily, a year ago, ChatGPT did the job for me. I don't have to apologize anymore because this is the thing in AI or its applications. But still, I want to make this remark to emphasize that this is very small. What I'm going to tell you is still a very small subset. There is a lot more, and I'll be glad to discuss it. Just for sake of concreteness, I have to focus on something reasonably specific and tell you how it applies. And again, my goal is going to be to apply to the same mathematical problem of understanding, for example, Poincaré conjecture, Slice-Ribbon conjecture, and answer this yes or no decision problems for pretty much generic knots with hundreds crossings. So that's going to be the plan. We're not there yet, so let's start a little bit before. So in fact, this is not 2015. This is 1971. It's one of the first AI systems which actually has a conversation with human about something. Here it's about shapes in a box. It was designed by Terry Winograd, who was at MIT at the time, so he was in Cambridge. This is the name of this AI system. I leave you as an exercise to figure out what this stands for, SHRDLU. And Terry is considered as one of the founding fathers in the subject or part of machine learning, natural language processing, natural language understanding. He has spent a lot of time on cognition and related fields. And since then, he moved to Stanford, so he has most of his career in Palo Alto. So this is one of his students from around 97. So he had pretty good run there. And this student is also quite famous himself. So he's famous for so-called PageRank algorithm. So many of you probably know him as Larry Page, co-founder of Google. So student of Terry Vinograd. A couple of other things that Terry did and are worth mentioning involve this so-called Vinograd schemas, the way we know them now today. So before even AI was inside, as far as powerful tool, Terry designed this kind of stress test examples that would be very sensitive to machines understanding the actual meaning of the sentence if they were to parse the information, translate the information, or do anything with information in that sentence. So typical task is translation, but basically that's same as understanding or extracting meaning from the sentence. So therefore, in what I'm going to proceed, I'll try to kind of walk you through this development which led to better understanding of information presented to the computer. So that's why natural language understanding is the right name for this area. And Vinograd schemas that Terry developed were basically examples of sentences where you probably have very little chance translating to another language or answering questions about unless you really understand the meaning. So here are some fancy, typical examples. The trophy would not fit in the brown suitcase because it was too big. So if I ask you what was too big in the sentence, we all quickly understand that trophy was too big, so it did not fit in whatever suitcase. But if you present this task to a machine really, or if there are some sentences that follow this one, you have to connect them in a natural way, which makes sense. So therefore, you actually have, in the next sentence or in whatever task you're doing, know that it was the trophy that's too big. So you really have to know this meaning. So here is another example. And these are pretty non-trivial, interesting examples, which are called Vinograd schemas, that are hard to either understand or translate, again, way before any of the AI or ML hype happened. So again, focusing for now on this area of natural language processing and understanding, and also focusing on a task which is rather special but broad enough, namely translation. Quick history is that machine translation was mostly statistical, which means probabilistic, in 90s and early 2000s. So the way it worked, again, there are many different variants, but basic idea was the following, that there are two systems. One is called language model, the other is translation model. So job of one is to take the input and using probabilities and various conditional probabilities and perhaps various different channels like beam translation and so on, present the information in the form of vector in some high dimensional space, and then pass this vector to yet another system, which would produce the output in a new language, or if you're parsing the sentence or doing something with this, basically process it in a way that you want to process it. So both systems in old days, meaning 90s and early 2000s, operated with probabilities. So that's why it was called statistical machine translation. Here on this slide, this is what SMT refers to, statistical machine translation. So as you can see, neural machine translation, which uses AI and machine learning, starts taking over precisely around this 2015 mark that I already mentioned earlier. So this is where things start changing. And one of my goals is to explain what's happening here, why this phenomenon occurs, and what is under the hood that's firing this guy. So in machine learning, there are many questions. If you're doing project on machine learning, there are many questions you want to answer. So one and probably most important question is about data sets. So I'll come back to this in the end if I have time. So this is the most important question. How did you get data set, what it includes, if there are biases, and so on and so forth. Usually, it's such an obvious question that people don't pay attention to it, but it's actually one of the most important ones. Then there are a couple of other questions, which involve how you present your data to a computer. So this is data encoding, data presentation. And here, I'm not going to spend too much time on it. Again, if you have questions, please ask me. But I'll try to explain a couple of other things. So another important part of project in machine learning is what algorithm you use from data science or computer science perspective to analyze your data, and also what is the architecture of the neural net that you're using. So for hard questions, questions like sliceness and Poincaré conjecture, it will be very important for us to, first of all, experiment with many different architectures, with many different algorithms. And this is what in data science people do. They experiment. We don't have a good theory yet. And we find the best thing that works. So it's extremely important because one will work and the other will not. So it's important to choose the right data presentation, algorithm, and architecture for your particular project. So this is architecture, which is perhaps one of the first and simplest in successful machine translation, coming back to our task. It's called seq-to-seq. It's a sequence-to-sequence architecture, which basically does what the name says. It takes the input as a sequence of either characters or words or sentences, and very much like in statistical machine translation, produces a vector in some high-dimensional abstract space. Let's call it meaning vector, and passes this to another component of your system whose job is to produce the output. So usually the way it's realized is with so-called RNNs. So these are recurrent neural nets, which are taking the input or producing the output in a very recurrent fashion. They're themselves quite interesting and came to the scene in early 2000s. There are lots of developments which led to that. But at a very basic level, this seq-to-seq is mirroring what we saw in statistical machine translation. There are basically two components, which in this current state are called encoder and decoder, but they're very parallel to what I called language model and translation model just a minute ago. So as you can see, this particular architecture is not perfect. So this is actually what was used in many tasks, in particular by Google Translate, back around 2014, 2015. And those of you who read German probably noticed that this real-time example or actual example is not perfect at all, because the input sentence is, you asked us to call you back after last Friday. The translation here is, wir hoffen jedoch, dass Sie bei Ihrer Reiseplanung weiterhilft. So there is no word Friday in the translation. If I were to convert it back to English, the most accurately I can, this sentence probably would say, nevertheless, we hope that you'll call us back about your travel plans. So you can kind of see how this mishap happened. It's not ideal. It's not really too far. It's not talking about kitchen appliances or random things. It's roughly about maybe talking to a travel agent or something like that, but it's very poor translation. And of course, a lot of this happened around 2014, 2015. I don't read many of these languages, so those of you who do can probably have a lot more fun with trying to see how this happened. So it's not totally outlandish. Okay, so it wasn't perfect. But if you want to trust your life to self-driving car, which makes this kind of mistakes, well, that's a bit of a problem, right? Any questions about seq-to-seq architecture?
Sorry, I didn't get, like, what have changed in 2015? Because you said that the architecture before was similar to what we have now.
Yeah, so that's actually one of the points I'm coming to. So this is one of the things that, lots of things. It was indeed very explosive growth of many different developments. So what I mentioned is, back about seq-to-seq is that statistical machine translation was good, but it had, as you can see, it's plateauing. I mean, people were studying it for 20 plus years, and it was very hard to squeeze more results out of it, so statistically. So neural machine translation basically was very poor before, but part of my job is precisely to explain this explosive growth. So there are many, many things that contributed to it. So, by the way, I should probably have said that what's the vertical axis? So sometimes this is the question I get. So that maybe since you asked, and we made this digression, let me comment on that. So this is called this blue score. So this is bilingual evaluation understudy. So that's a score that in translational tasks and similar tasks, people usually give to quality. And average person like myself, who poorly knows more than two or so languages, would probably get exactly around 20-something, okay? So 30 is usually considered pretty decent, so that's pretty good. And 40 is like, oh, wow, stratosphere. That's an absolute top. We'll see the scores later on. But anyway, you see that here we're not even good. We're like, okay. Right, so what happened is that first architectures like this started exploding like mushrooms. People actually experimented a lot, brainstormed a lot, and improved on what can be used and how. So algorithms and architectures is one of the key components of any project in ML. So again, I'll expose you to only a couple, but you'll see quickly the comparison and what I'm going to tell you next, that each one will be better than the predecessor. And things happen very, very quickly around 2015. So that's basically growth and explosion of tools that we can use. That's what happened.
So when you talk about algorithms, you mean learning algorithms or?
I mean, yes, learning algorithms, how we use this architecture, what exactly we do with that, yeah. So there are all these combinations, data encoding, algorithm, and architecture. These are the key choices that we, A, have to decide and experiment with for each given task. For complicated tasks like the ones I'm trying to tackle, this is extremely crucial because some combination will work and the other combination will totally flop. Any other questions? Okay, so how can we do better? So this is actually something that happened just around 2015 and came from computer vision, but then was quickly adopted by people who care about translation and machine learning in general, AI in general. This is called attention mechanism. So this is basically a mechanism which is helping to solve several problems at once. And the issue with seek-to-seek architecture was that you took information in sequence, and it wasn't very easy, first of all, to go back. If you think about like a tree-like structure, then if you're already on some path in choosing or adopting weights in the neural net up to a certain point, it's not very easy for you to go back. So this also relates to another problem that different parts of the text, the farther apart, are not really well correlated, and that's an issue. And another related problem is that each neural net or each layer of the neural net is basically some function, typically a combination of linear function with some activation function like sigmoid. And if you compose this RNN inputs and outputs many times, what you get is convolution of this function with itself many, many times. And it will typically lead to vanishing gradients, which are crucial for neural net to learn something. So all of these problems are closely related, and the issue is that the seek-to-seek and other simple architecture cannot hold meaning over or correlation of a text over a kind of global large chunk. So that's exactly what we need in topology, for instance, where I'll be feeding the data of a knot, and we need to keep the global meaning. If I change only one crossing, lots of things change. So therefore, it's important to take this information as a whole. And that's the issue that's going to be solved here with this attention mechanism. It came from, again, computer vision. And what it does, along with the usual kind of feed-forward type structure, it tries to take and record context. It basically produces correlations among different parts of either sentence with itself or sentence in one language and sentence in a different language. I think I illustrated here on the next slide. That this input is recorded is in the form that can be called attention matrix. It's basically, again, this correlation, the highlight or how these different fields light up tell you how, in this case, for example, German sentence and English sentence correlate with each other among different parts. Here is a self-correlation between between the parts of the sentence with itself. It's an English sentence. The animal didn't cross the street because it was too tired. If I ask you who was tired, animal or street, there are, again, machine can answer that either one, but of course there is here only one right answer. And what this attention matrix does, it lights up this neurons stronger in those cases where correlation is better or more suitable. So therefore, it basically provides context to what we had before, say, in the seek-to-seek architecture. And what happened here in 2017 is a revolution, which is responsible for the letter T in GPT. So this is architecture called Transformer. And that's actually what we use a lot these days. So GPT is, of course, device that or software that we play a lot with these days. And that's exactly the revolution I mentioned earlier. But the key ingredient was this thing, the transformer. So what this guy said, it's a DeepMind team, or Google Brain team, sorry, they're actually different, which said that take attention mechanism that I described earlier and throw away everything else, basically capitalize on this. This, of course, is a little bit of overstatement because it's a fairly complicated architecture. It has many different bells and whistles. For instance, it has simplest possible feed-forward networks. It has actually many copies of the attention mechanism I mentioned before called multi-head attention. What it does, it tries to record correlations for different things. For instance, you may want to base correlation in your sentence depending on who did something or it happened to whom or did what and so on. So this would be different channels. That's what multi-head attention is responsible for. And then there are lots of other things. For instance, there is very interesting version of a Fourier transform used to do positional encoding. So that's part of the way how it keeps basically knowledge over fairly significant chunk of text or more global information about the data. And as you can see here, it says that, well, we basically get to 40s in the blue score. So we go from 20s to 40s. And that's the rapid transition that happened from 2015 to 2017. At this point, Google Translate switched from previous mechanisms quickly to neural machine translation and, of course, using Transformer. And this is an illustration on how it performed on this Vinograd schemas, the complicated non-trivial sentences that most of the previous versions, for example, seek-to-seek and other versions didn't get right, but Transformer actually does really well. So the cow ate the hay because it was delicious. If I ask you who was delicious, cow or the hay? So there are many ways to answer it, but in this sentence, for the purpose of this sentence, it's the hay. And when you translate sentences like this in different languages, you have to get meaning right for a number of reasons. For instance, in English, we don't have too much variation in terms of gender and inclinations and so on, but richer languages like Asian languages or French in this example have a lot of that, and you have to get it right from the meaning of the sentence in order to translate it, because there is no counterpart in a different language. Okay. Any other questions? So Lukasz Kaiser, who used to be in Google Brain at the time and now went to OpenAI, he actually gives really good talks where you can find them on YouTube about this stage in development of Google Brain. So he points out that this transformer, the reason it became one of the coolest technologies in town is because it can do many, many different tasks. So for instance, if you ask Transformer to write Wikipedia article, this is just based on this second component. So Transformer sometimes is used not necessarily as a two-component system. You can just have encoder-only or decoder-only version. So you can ask it to generate a Wikipedia article based on a single word as a starting word. And the starting word here is the Transformer itself. And that's the Wikipedia article it generates. It's actually quite realistic. It pretends that Transformer is some Japanese rock band. It knows that rock bands have some drama, dissolve, drummer quits or something, I don't know. And it's pretty good, it's very decent. So you can actually see 2017 precursor of ChatGPT. You would know back then that ChatGPT should happen, and that's how these days we know that many other things should happen. Anyway, the story does not end here. We were doing a project with colleagues I'm gonna tell you about in a second, when people actually improved on Transformer, so they called Reformer, this new architecture, which is, as the name says, name of the article is Efficient Transformer. And a cool thing is that some of you may know the father of the first author here. So I was giving this talk at Caltech, and actually many of my Caltech colleagues know son of Alexei Kitaev. So he's responsible for this cool thing. So these are kind of some architectures, some of the things that we tried. There are many, many more. I gave you like quick expose of several things. And now we can try to apply to some of the problems such as answer is a given knot with, I don't know, 40, 50, 100 crossings, ribbon or slice. So that's a yes or no decision problem. These days I studied several variants of the problem. One is with various colleagues who are listed here. And one is, simply deciding if a complicated knot diagram presented to you is trivial or not. So this can be gamified very easily because it's a complicated state space where you have all kinds of diagrams, but you have only three basic moves. It's much easier than chess or Go for that matter. You just have three Rademeister moves, and claim or question is, using these three Rademeister moves, can you win the game? Namely, can you unknot a complicated tangled diagram? So ribbon or slice is basically same thing where you add one more move. It's called ribbon move, not surprisingly. And again, it's same game. And then in combinatorial group theory, there is Andrew Spurious conjecture, which is actually the same kind of thing, except it's phrased in, using combinatorics and group theory about presentations of trivial groups. And then you are supposed to either find or not find a path to a trivial presentation using only a couple of basic moves. So problems like this are ideal for AI because you have large configuration space, many positions on a board, if you think about board games, but only a couple of basic moves. And here we would be in a vanilla position because the number of moves is very limited. It's only three or four. For this it's three, for this it's four, and here it's also three. So very, very easy, very fun.
Sorry, is there a simple graphical way to understand the ribbon move as the one upstairs, or is way more complicated to represent?
No, it's actually it's pretty simple. So ribbon move, so it's basically this. So if you allow to go from, if you allow to go from here to here, then this is ribbon move. Yeah. So that's the one. So basically, you had one more move to the other guys. In fact, before I started this project 3 years ago, I would say, or 4 years ago, I would say that all of them are in the same complexity class. So if we solve one, we should immediately solve the other. Now going down this rabbit hole and seeing details and nuances, I see actually interesting differences between them and comparison. So that's yet another story. I guess I'm not going to be able to go in that. Here. Oh, by the way, here is the ribbon move. Yeah, it's already illustrated on the slide. But anyway, let's pretend that they're all very similar, and I'll explain just the first one because that's maybe easier to explain and relate. But I want to point out that every good machine learning talk should leave you with a present. You know, like when you go to children's birthday, everybody gets a present. So every good machine learning talk should come with this, okay? It should be open source code that you can download for yourself on your own laptop and play with. If it's not usable, if it's too clumsy, poorly written, that's a bad thing, okay? If it's not even available, like in teams that involve DeepMind and Google and so on, that's even worse because they tell you about something but you can actually play with yourself. So cool thing is, I encourage you, even though I'm gonna be talking about that part, go here, download it and play it with yourself. If you have difficulty, if you have complaints, please write to us and we'll improve on it, okay? So that's the social residue that every ML talk should give you. You shouldn't walk out empty-handed, okay? Now, speaking about this unknotting question, so suppose we want to decide.
How does the reformer or the transformers help with this question? Because it's not obvious that like there's an attention span with these moves, or like, yeah.
Well, so it helps because I'm in the remaining 2 minutes, I'm not going to explain like in detail what we do. I'll be happy to say more in maybe question time. But it's a very good question. This problem is about knots. All of them, these presentations of trivial groups that enter Andrews Curtis conjecture, they require global information about the input data. For instance, as I say, if I change one crossing in the knot in this complicated diagram, it may go from trivial. This is actually trivial. To be honest, I don't know. to non-trivial, right? So you see the point that you have to see the whole thing at once and process how it's interconnected. Knowing just local information is not enough. So that's where a transformer actually helps. It helps to keep attention, no pun intended, over large distances. So, but we didn't use transformer. Yes?
Even for like, I guess like the human brain is supposed to be good at this, right? Like processing sort of like the global information as well as local information. But even for, like, I don't know, for me, for example, it's very difficult to understand this complicated knot. What is the advantage that comes from, what is the advantage that a machine learning algorithm, I guess, has over us?
A lot. Let me return to this question. Indeed, we're close enough to the end, so I'll try to answer this, but a lot. So first of all, it will tell you immediately about this knot. So it can do many things. The reason I'm excited about this development is that, as I said, as quantum topologist, there was so much I could do. It was plateauing like natural statistical machine translation. But now we have a new tool. We can do a lot more. So we can easily answer these questions for 100 crossing knots, so which is quite exciting. So it can process tasks that again, otherwise would not be possible. But then there are completely different ways in which it can, for example, recognize patterns. I'm not talking about this in this talk, but that's yet another domain where it can help. So I'm not sure if I'm answering your question right.
Yeah, also, so I understood that there's a series of steps, or rather rules, that you are what is it, to transform the knot, and somehow if you perform enough of those transformations, you want to get the desired, that's why I'm understanding it right
yeah.
now, but it might be.
Yeah, that's exactly right, yeah. Okay. So all these important questions like sliceness or ribbonness, these are yes or no decision problems.
Yeah.
And it's decidable, first of all, that you can transform every knot to either trivial knot if it's a slice or ribbon, or you cannot do this. So it's a very concrete yes or no kind of sequence of things. Point is that we don't have any reasonable polynomial time algorithm to do it. In fact, we don't have any reasonable algorithm to do it. Forget polynomial time.
Okay, so it's about trying to apply all the transformations in the right order so that, and then there's a combinatorial
exactly.
explosion.
Exactly, exactly. Combinatorial explosion kills all these problems. That's exactly what's holding us away from smooth Poincaré conjecture in dimension form. Just that? Yeah.
So AI can tell you this knot is a knotable, right, for example?
Yes.
How do you check if it's actually?
Okay, so, yeah. it's okay, I'll use 3 more minutes of the time to go over the rest of the slides, and then, yeah, this would be perfect questions for, yeah, so what did we do? So first, there are two things you can do. First, you can try to ask AI or ML to recognize if this is knotted or not knotted, if this is ribbon or not ribbon, like predict, okay? And then you can also try to train RL to play the game, to do a sequence of moves. If the second actually is completely mathematically rigorous, because if it shows, if it tells you that, oh yeah, this is the sequence of moves, you just verify it. In fact, you put it directly in the paper and publish the paper with that result. So anyway, that's what we did. I said that Reformer was very fancy version, even better than Transformer, but we found a couple of surprises. So first, on this first task, we found that Reformer is just as good as basic feed-forward neural network. So if you're not familiar with these different architectures, feed-forward neural net is very much like Honda Civic, and Reformer is, I don't know, a fanciest version of the Lexus, okay? So, and it turned out that they're performing just as well, both of them. I mean, you don't need fancy thing. It worked really well. Second thing, which was surprising, is that if you give it more complicated knots with more crossings, it actually does better. So we don't have a full explanation to this. It's an interesting question in data science, computer science, why this phenomena happened. And again, I'll be happy to discuss this afterwards. The second is more fun. And part of the explanation could be that if you play against more stronger opponent in chess, you actually learn better. So that's maybe keep this analogy. And that may be why, if you see more interesting crossings, here n is the number of crossings, you perform better. So this was a prediction, like yes or no, and you can see that performance goes to 99%. So usually that's kind of plot you expect in an ML paper. That's where you celebrate. Your quality is clear, close to 100%. So that was for yes or no. This is a similar plot for reinforcement learning, which actually plays the game. So it actually finds the moves. And here again, there are a couple of different architectures. So we didn't talk about this. So green dots is random walker. It's basically making the moves at random. And this is usually benchmarked for comparison in various other algorithms, because neural nets typically are initialized to do random things at first. As you can see, it does very poorly. If your number of crossings increases, it never finds the right solution. So of course, we never expected it, okay? But what's interesting is that there is another algorithm called asynchronous advantage actor critic, A3C for short, is usually pretty good, but here it didn't perform very well. So this illustrates that a point I mentioned before, you have for your own problem, for your own project, you have to experiment, you have to try different things. So what did perform is this algorithm called cross-region policy optimization. It's one of the policy algorithms, TRPO for short. And I'll illustrate it on the next slide, but you can see that it actually performs quite well. And accuracy, again, approaches 100%. So that's what you want to see on this kind of plot. So what is, this is last thing I'm going to say, and last bit of information about machine learning. What is trust region policy optimization, TRPO, this thing that worked really well? So most of the neural nets, in the simplest ones, they're based on some kind of gradient descent. It's an optimization problem, okay? It's just how you approach this optimization problem, and typically you have some cost or loss function, and you try to optimize it. Problems with this, most of the time, is that if your landscape of rewards or losses is very rigged, like illustrated in this figure, you may make the step in the right direction. But if the step is too big, you may fall and never recover, okay? So that's what happens. TRPO is more conservative. What it does is the following. So it says, okay, where you are currently in your state, you draw a region around it, and you optimize within that region. So it's much safer. It's a little slower, and in terms of resources, it takes more compute power, but it performs better, and that's part of the reason why previous plot was good. So here we found some new results in terms of ribbonness. This is an example of a knot with 14 crossings. It wouldn't have been possible if we can process, again, 50 or 100 crossing knots. I already showed you that you should download this piece of software, play with it. Every good talk should have a social residue. So here is the one. And last thing I want to do is to advertise that in a couple of weeks, if you got excited about the subject, buy tickets now. It's perfect time to fly to Pasadena, and we'll have String Data annual conference hosted there. And finally, I want to thank you for your attention.
You mentioned the gradient disappear, vanishing gradient problem. In your projects, have you ever run into such a problem? And if yes, what did you do to solve this?
We ran into lots of other problems, not this one, because luckily for us, any kind of transformer typically is, if that's an issue, if we need to keep context over global chunk of data, attention mechanism and transformers or reformers solve that.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, in that sense, it wasn't an issue. Our first project here with Jim Halverson, Fabian Ruel, and Piotr Sikorsky took a couple of years. It was actually good that we were slow on this, because each day there were new architectures and algorithms coming up. And when we started it, Reformer was not available. When we finished it, we actually used Reformer as one of the possibilities. And that did the job for us. Yeah.
Can you also show the last figure that has a lot of dots?
This one? Or?
No, the plot.
Oh, the plot.
Yes, this one. So the TRPO at around 40 had a dip. What is that dip about?
Oh, that's a good question. So yeah, to this I don't actually have a good answer off the top of my head. I don't think we even discussed it in the paper. So actually that's another fun thing you find, that I approach this as a like working mathematician. I want to solve sliceness, ribbonness of knots. But then you end in a territory where you're discussing data, in this case, synthetic data. It doesn't come from observation, but we make data, of course. And there are lots of interesting questions like this dip that you're pointing out. So it's a great question. I don't have an immediate answer to this. So in fact, all of them seem to dip. So the difference is that this other algorithm dips, recovers, and still goes down. TRPO improves. So that's a very good question. I have no idea. I suspect it probably has an answer. Again, I don't know if you have explanation in the paper. It may have as a possibility. I don't think that's the case. But for instance, it could have been that the way our data prepared is centered around 40 crossing knots, and something happens here. Again, I'm pretty sure that's not the case, because we ensured that for data science papers, you have to eliminate all kinds of biases and make sure your data is extremely uniform in every single sense of this word. So that's not probably the explanation, but it could be something like that. I don't know. Very good question.
So yeah, given the set of the problem, it seems that I feel like a really important learning approach like would fit naturally. And I imagine you guys tried, or I don't know, because there seems like there's an agent that has to make decisions at any given point, and there's a state of the world, which would be the state of the knot, presume how entangled or untangled it is, and
yeah,
that feels very natural for reinforcement learning.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're doing here. So these are different. Yeah, these are RL algorithms. Yeah.
Okay. And the transformer is, well, somehow. But yeah, I don't know exactly how those interface, but it provides some weight function.
Transformer is architecture. This is algorithm. So they can be. So that's why they can be mixed and matched. So it's not exclusive. So this can work, for example, in transformer or some other form. So that's a fun part of this game. That again, it's not an exact science yet. It's very empirical. So experimentation is important, and I feel it's like a good candy store where you walk and you can take off the shelf, oh, let's try this, let's try that, and they work in different ways, and we can position and combine it in different ways. So actually, that's another maybe point to mention, that even on the same problem with the same exact goal, like, oh, can we undo the knot, so find whether or not it's a ribbon or slice, it's actually good if other groups try the same thing, because most likely, you guys, for instance, if you try it, you're not going to use exactly the same architecture and algorithms, and you may find completely different results. And whether it's positive or negative would be extremely useful, because now for data science, because data scientists want to know on what kind of tasks, for what reasons, different algorithms work and do not work. And questions like why there is a dip and so on would be interesting to them.
Yeah, still the same plot. Beyond the deep, does it mean that for the TRPO, the larger problem, it has better accuracy?
It looks like I don't know how it probably it's probably an artifact of this deep. I think what it should be is just a more or less flat line. In fact, here this plot does not indicate it. As we reach 100 crossings, we should probably go further. Surely at some point there will be a decline. I mean, it cannot stay 100% for long. And TRPO in this case performed really well. So I would just expect flat line. I don't know why there is a dip. So that's a great question. So there is another plot which indicates that nothing interesting happening. I have a couple of extra plots. For instance, here it's a little easier to see. This is same thing as function of number of crossings, how many steps the reinforcement learning has to make to win the game, to find in this path, namely how long is the path on average. And what it's showing is that as the braid gets longer, the number of steps also grows, but as you can see, it grows just proportionately to what you would expect it to be. For a longer braid of, say, let's length 100, you need roughly 100 steps. And that's what it's saying. It's saying that, yeah, you need, I don't know, maybe order 100. And it's pretty linear here. But what I would expect is that this graph will go to stratosphere at some point, maybe 200, 300. I don't think we experimented with that. And this graph will go down so that performance decreases at some point. But at this range, I would just expect the flat line.
So you don't think it's somehow it's just easier to unknot something with a lot of crossings? It could be perhaps.
I don't think it's easier to unknot something with a lot of crossings. that would be way counter my intuition. Again, if that's true, that would be pretty cool. That's definitely not what I'm trying to say. I think in this case, this behavior, it's actually a comparison of different colors. So that I would attribute to the fact that something with larger number of crossings makes you a better player. But actually, there is another thing that goes into this. It would only make sense if there is something like polynomial time algorithm that we don't know about, but machine has found. And that would explain this behavior, that seeing more crossings just reaffirms that polynomial time algorithm that it found is good. It's basically confirming it and good to go. Whether that's part of the explanation here, I'm hesitant to say. I mean, it could be, but I don't know.
From the point of view of proving or disproving the four-manifold conjecture, Now that we have like such a nice tool, such a powerful tool that checks this property, how do you imagine this will get us closer to either proving or disproving this difficult error?
So 2 years ago, what we did imagine with my colleagues, now this team involved Cipri and Manalescu, is that just doing exactly the same thing as with unknotting, we can tell immediately, at least in the range of 100, whether or not a slice or not slice, or more precisely, ribbon and not ribbon. And that's very cool because that's something that, again, we have no strict mathematical tools nor physical tools to do yet otherwise. So we were basically thinking that at this point, I would be telling you about existing counterexample that we found. We haven't found one. So some of my colleagues, maybe actually including Ciprian, now think in this from this perspective that maybe this SPC4 smooth punk crack conjecture is actually true. I don't know, so I think that's a possibility. That's one way to interpret this data. That what we did in this project, and you can play with it yourself. We actually covered the range roughly up to 70 crossings quite confidently. So what we did and trained, and again, I encourage you to try it yourself because I think we made some mistakes initially by using data representation which did not allow us to go back and change too many things. So we didn't even cover the full range of 100 crossings. We did basically up to 70 or 80. I can show you some graphs. But within that range, we actually did not we produce lots of new math results, which can be rigorous theorems and pretty cool, a la Lisa Piccirillo statement. But I think that's one of them. I had it here. But we did not find counterexample. So even though we scanned through millions and billions of new knots and pairs of knots, which would be potential counterexamples. So we rule them out all. And again, maybe that's indication that Poincaré conjecture is true. So that's one way to take it. I personally was hoping it would be false. I want to be mischievous. I rule something out, yeah.
Are those ribbon and knotting problems known to be in certain complexity class?
Yeah, very good question. So ribbon is, but all of them are considered hard. So there is no good statement for this one or this one. For knotting problem, it's also within past 10, 15 years that progress has been made in putting them in right complexity classes. It's known to be in complexity class NP, non-deterministic polynomial time. So it's like Sudoku puzzle. You can not solve the problem in polynomial time, but you can quickly check the answer. Then it was also proven that it's in complexity class co-NP. In other words, you can verify negation with a polynomial time certificate, but you don't have polynomial time algorithm. What's interesting is that many problems that started at the intersection of NP and co-NP complexity classes ended up in polynomial time. For example, primality is one famous example. But some are not. For example, deciding whether integer number is a product of two primes, it's in complexity class NP and co-NP, but it's not polynomial time. So in view of this, I don't know. I suspect that, for example, the reason we have this graph and that it flies on any neural net and does so well, probably to me, again, my colleagues probably not going to subscribe, but I would say it's indication that there is polynomial time algorithm and neural net just found it, and that's why. But that's a very good question.
So, a couple of things. So when you say accuracy, does it mean that the condition for failure would be it tried to unknot it and it couldn't find that it was trivial and it declared untrivial, but actually had it tried harder, it would have found that it was trivial? Is that?
Yeah, exactly. That's one way to quantify. So another thing I learned in the past several years is that in data science, to publish a paper in their journals, you have to be super precise about questions like this. So I already mentioned that preparing and analyzing data sets in unbiased way is extremely important. Same is how exactly you measure things. What are your benchmarks, how you compare it, and so on. So indeed, that would be one most natural measure here, that since in my talk, all decision problems are very simple, yes or no, it's a binary. So you basically try to evaluate number of cases where you fail to the absolute truth if you have other access to absolute truth. So what's interesting is that with unknotting problem, we have that. Because there are algorithms, they're just not polynomial time, but if you wait long enough, you can actually decide. The problem here, or here, is that there are no algorithms at all. This question becomes much, much more interesting. So you can usually verify one direction in some way, or you can verify it on part of your data set, which is prepared so you know what the answer is. But again, since we don't have any algorithm, any way to do it, it's an extremely non-trivial question how you properly quantify so that it's not fake news, that it's actually a very legitimate measurement problem. So, yeah.
Oh, and that makes me think, like, how do you do it at all? If you have no proxy for success in the sense of if you have no way to verify it, what does the training data say? What does it look like? Is it competing against itself? And, well, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. So, luckily, in these problems, it becomes much harder to quantify things. And it's a great discussion. I'm actually glad that we're having this discussion. Let's continue it over lunch. I apologize for overstating my welcome. But you would do something like that. You would basically try to either have it play against itself, or our goal is to, in very practical terms, try to play the game on each concrete example and see if it can produce new wins that we haven't seen before. And this could be used as a zero-level approximation to what success looks like in this kind of project, that it can show that something is sliced or ribbon way beyond what best topologists in the world can do. And if the answer is yes, then that's already good enough. But you're absolutely right that quantifying this, and that's why another reason why I'm not presenting graphs here, because we would have to have more in-depth discussion on this, which again, I'm happy to continue.
Okay. Thank you very much.